Innovation meets the law.
Good morning and welcome to True Talk. This is your host, Samal Jarrah. Today marks January 25th, which means a few years ago, there was the beginning of the Arab Spring in Egypt. Listen to this song. It's called Long Live Egypt, Tahya Masr. And Ahmed and I, we're going to be right back. This is WMNF 88.5 FM.
نستسلم ونرجع تاني تحيا مصر ولا نتنازل عن شيء تحيا مصر مش عايزين غير حقنا الإنساني تحيا مصر عدالة اجتماعية وعين تحيا مصر مش هنسكت تاني ولا هنداري اللي زبالنا كفاية ظلم وفقر وكفاية بامل تحيا مصر وتحيا الحرية ثورة حتى مصر في كل الدنيا تحيا مصر وتحيا الحرية ثورة ثورة حتى مصر تحيا مصر مصر شبابها رجالة تحيا مصر وشعبها كله أبطال تحيا مصر مش هننسى دم شهدانا تحيا مصر جاب لنا عزتنا من نظام تحيا لا عزج ولا استبداد وفساد لا في مصر ولا في غيرها تحيا تونس وفلسطين والوحدة العربية تحيا مصر وتحيا الحرية ثورة حتى النصر في أم الدنيا دي تحيا مصر وتحيا الحرية ثورة ثورة حتى النصر تحيا مصر مشوار بدأوا أجدادنا بكرامة هنبني حياتنا علشان دي مصر بلدنا وهنبنيها لأولادنا مشوار بدأوا أجدادنا بكرامة هنبنى حياتنا علشان دي مصر بلدنا وهنبنيها لأولادنا تحيا مصر وتحيا الحرية ثورة حتى النصر في أم الدنيا دي تحيا مصر وتحيا الحرية ثورة ثورة
نحرك بلادنا ونحل مشاكلنا ونرجع الكرامة لشعبنا.
We can help our country to be better.
Good morning and welcome back to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah. Good morning, Ahmed. This is a very touching day, I am sure, for you. Ahmed, he's not there. He should
be.
Okay, Ahmed is on Skype and trying to arrange for the next interview. January 25th was and still is the like the day of police in Cairo, Egypt, and usually it's a holiday and people go to the, you know, they just take a holiday. A few young people decided that on January 25th 2011 they will be demonstrating in the street. They really didn't know how many people will show up. It was just a Facebook page, Kulluna Khalid Saeed, and maybe Ahmed can explain what that was. And then thousands and thousands and thousands of young people went to the streets. It was very cold, unexceptionally cold in that day in Egypt, and rainy, and tear gases were used against the young people who went to the streets, and water cannons, and things really escalated and you know, went out of control. Are you there, Ahmed?
Yes, Samar, I'm here.
So I was just telling our listeners that January 25th has a very significant meaning to you, because you're originally Egyptian, and I think I was going to ask you, because you left here. Like, we were doing this show together all the time, and you told me, I can't, I have to go. But before you tell me why you left, I just mentioned that this whole thing started, it has a background, but there was this web page called Kulluna Khalid Saeed. So I thought maybe you can explain to our listeners who was Khalid Saeed and why this page prompted. Yeah, go ahead.
Kulluna Khalid Saeed, which means we are all Khalid Saeed, a young man from Alexandria who had posted or forwarded some sort of image that was critical of the state. The police forces, security forces, ended up tracking him down in an internet cafe that he used to go to and tortured him to death. Some suggested that they also threw him over the roof. And he was brutally murdered, a young man, and it outraged so many of the young activists in Egypt at the time that the level of police brutality that the police was willing to go to, and they started this Facebook page called "We're All Khalid Saeed," and it was run anonymously by different activists. And when the Arab Spring happened, it was really sparked in Tunisia. When a man there, a merchant that was a street vendor, was selling things in the market and apparently had a cart without a license. So the police in Tunisia would round up and beat up people there and remove and destroy their merchandise. And this person who was a young man who didn't have a lot of opportunities had enough, and he lit himself on fire. And that sparked the revolution there, the uprising. And it was just it was happening, and that the Egyptians had seen what was happening there, which led to the downfall of the regime there. And that energized this protest that was going to happen on January 25th in Egypt, which was, coincided with the national holiday for police, or to recognize the police. And the police in Egypt had this reputation, instead of being in service of the public, they had it where the public was in service. This was a slogan back then, that the public is in service of the police, because the police oppression was so bad. So that was the reason people went out on January 25th to demand an end to police brutality. It wasn't necessarily, they weren't calling for a revolution, which eventually turned into that.
So, Ahmed, why did you leave the U.S. and go there?
Well, as we were watching it from far, and of course, I myself was, because I'm from Egypt originally, I had been monitoring what was happening there. And when I'd go back to Egypt from time to time, family relatives would tell me how bad things are there. And in fact, I had a brother that lived there or a couple of brothers, and they would be subjected to these routine harassments by the cops. And when the uprising started, it gave a sense of hope that things were, would change for the better. But it was after the January 25th. January 25th, a few young people came out to Tahrir Square to protest. The police reaction to them, it was so brutal. that it triggered a backlash from the public. And I think it was January 28th, the first Friday after the revolution, that people really came out in large numbers to protest the reaction of the police to the initial protest. And from there, it became a sit-in. And we're watching it from here. We organized a couple of protests in Tampa. I remember being on the corner of Kennedy and Dale Mabry, protesting that. We did some media stuff, standing in solidarity with the Egyptians. And then, you know, then I just said, you know, I want to be part of this history. So I actually, you know, booked a flight to go to Egypt. And at this point, you know, there were very few flights. Most flights to Egypt were canceled, especially direct flights from the United States. I had to go through a couple other countries and finally made it in, you know, towards it kind of, you know, basically towards the end of the protest, what ended up being an end of the protest, arriving on the night that Mubarak was for, you know, announced that he's stepping down.
Wow, amazing. Actually, people were leaving Egypt at the time. I remember my sister, she lives in Egypt, and she's married to an Egyptian, but the King of Jordan had sent planes to evacuate Jordanians, especially women and their children. And I remember, Ahmed, that my daughter, my sister was at the airport, and they would not let her daughters because they had Egyptian citizenship. And I remember also tweeting to my to the Secretary of State, Foreign Minister. He was a friend and a colleague when I worked at Jordan Television. And I told him, I mean, my sister can't leave her daughters in Egypt. And he said, okay, I'll get on it. And actually called the Royal Jordanian in Egypt, the counter at the airport, and said, please allow any Jordanian mother to leave with her kids, even if they are not Jordanian, that don't have Jordanian citizenship. So people were afraid and leaving, not Egyptians, but you know, expats and foreigners were leaving, and yet you went there. Of course, so many things happened since that day, since the time Mubarak abdicated or left his throne. You know, he's a president, but seemed like he was a king, and then things went haywire. Ahmed, I want to play this part of documentary, maybe a few minutes, if you don't mind, because it gets the feeling of the people. Some of what our listeners would be listening to is in Arabic, and most of it is in English. But these are young Egyptians going to a demonstration in the street, something they have never done in their lives. And most of them were born when Mubarak was ruling, and now they are in their late 20s and still Mubarak is ruling. So it's very significant. So Ahmed, if I may ask you to be quiet, because I'm going to use the same path. This is WMNF 88.5 FM, and this is True Talk, and this is Samar and Ahmed, and this is a part of a documentary that it is called The End of the Dictator.
We'll ever witness such a day in our lives.
It felt like your skin is burning, like you just want to peel your skin off.
When Tunisia happened and people asked me, do you think Egypt is next? And everyone here said, nonsense, you know, this is a different situation. There's so much apathy here, and nobody wants change.
But as all the world now knows, the young people did want change, and the revolution was being driven by them. Muaz Abdul Karim is a 28-year-old pharmacist. He was part of the Coalition of Youth of Revolution, who organized the day of protest on January the 25th.
بدأ الحشد اليوم 25 يناير قبلها بحوالي شهر بدأت في صورة حوارات بنتكلم مع بعض عن طريق الفيسبوك ونتكلم مع بعض في الشارع في القهاوي وفي الأماكن اللي بنتجمع فيها كمجموعة من الشباب النشطين في وقفة احتجاجية في أعمال داخل الشارع فتحديدا احنا بدأنا نتكلم عن ان احنا عايزين نعمل يوم نعدله زي يوم 6 ابريل وزي يوم 4 مايو يوم نقف فيه ضد الطوارئ وضد المحاكم العسكرية وضد التعذيب اللي بيحصل في مصر
عادي as soon as possible لعلمك السكر بره
60% of Egypt's population is below the age of 30. Young, well-educated people who might have been expected to support Mubarak, but they're the ones taking the lead in the pursuit of change.
I've never felt that I'm proud to be Egyptian until the movement started, until it turned into a revolution. That was the first time I ever feel that I'm Egyptian, and yes, I'm happy to be one. Before, I wasn't. And when I used to listen to the talks of my grandpa and my mom, when they used to tell me stories about how Egypt was great and how Egypt had the leading role in the region, and it was a powerful country, I've never seen it. I've never experienced it. Until the day that we started this on the 25th, I've seen the real power of the people of this country.
I think the amount of people who were uploading pictures instantaneously on Twitter and Facebook, that encouraged even more people to come down and participate and be in the protest.
Word spread more and more through word of mouth and through social networking and through websites and through messages and emails and Blackberries. And it was very fast and it was very quick, and people were all reacting very quickly. Even if they don't have Facebook accounts, some of their friends do.
At the very beginning, it was just the amount of people. That was very surprising, and that was what was so significant. We needed to get the word out and get media to come and cover and try to upload as much material as we want, because we knew that the government was going to use force, aggressive force, and this needed to be documented. And at the same time, we knew that the government was going to spread lies about the protesters.
With her video diary, Miral began documenting events to upload onto the web. Those citizens who had not caught on to the new media or were beyond the reach of independent TV channels were forced to rely for their information on state-controlled television. Shahir Amin was an experienced broadcaster for government-controlled Nile TV.
The media gave a semblance that it was free when it actually wasn't. We had independent newspapers. There was talk shows on state televisions that openly discussed all sorts of issues happening in Egypt. But of course, it was very much controlled. And there were always the red lines and the taboo issues that you couldn't touch. Criticizing the president was one of them.
After a day of mass protests in Egypt, the
faced with independent foreign broadcasters, social networking and the internet, the regime realized it had lost control of the information highway. It hit back with what it thought was its most powerful weapon, censorship.
Came Thursday night at maybe midnight or 1 o'clock, suddenly all the phones were shut. All the internet services were shut. The BlackBerry Messenger was shut. All communications, and for a specific time, even landlines weren't working. So this was unprovoked. When this happened, the demonstrators felt violated. We didn't do anything for you to do this to us. All we're doing is taking pictures and uploading them. So I think when this happened, this inspired a lot more people to participate.
The younger generation started on the 25th of January. And then there was word around that after Friday prayers on the 28th of January, we will go on for Tahrir Square.
When Dr. Wahabi went to join the demonstration in the square, he was surprised to meet the twin babies he delivered only days before.
Yeah, and I felt that if this lady comes down on that day with her twin babies, then we are really going for something big, and that we are defending something that is really formidable, and something that we should all participate in and never go back home until we completely get rid of this regime.
I knew that state television wasn't showing the real picture of what was happening on the ground. On state television, the presenters were repeatedly telling their viewers, that there were foreign agents fomenting the unrest, that people were getting paid to stay in the square in dollars, or they were getting Kentucky meals. I didn't see any of that.
The regime, they're saying that all the protesters are being bribed to demonstrate against the government by meals from KFC.
Yasmin Moll is an Egyptian educated in the USA who has returned to Cairo to complete her doctorate in cultural anthropology.
The regime making claims like that, they're just trying to really trivialize and delegitimize the very legitimate claims of the protesters by saying they're being bought off with like chicken wings and coleslaw salads. Just ridiculous.
Yasmin has been caught up in the events and actively supports the calls for Mubarak to go now.
I went on January 28th, and that was actually the scariest protest because we didn't know what to expect. So we got near the People's Assembly. Maybe there was like around 1,000 people there. And everybody was chanting, Sinmeya, Sinmeya, peaceful, peaceful. And then all of a sudden, they just started tear gassing us. And that was really bad. Like, I've never been tear gassed before, and I hope I never am again, but it felt like your skin is burning. Like, you just want to peel your skin off. And then your eyes are tearing up. I couldn't see, so I started crouching down. Then it became personal. You know what I mean? Like, when you're the one getting tear gassed and being called names and all that, and then it moves from something very abstract, like grievances against this regime, to like, I experience this on a body level, and I'm angry now. I don't know what color I should write stupid in.
In what appeared to be an orchestrated show of support for the regime, pro-government demonstrators appeared in increasing numbers and howled their contempt for the activists. It was Egyptian against Egyptian.
Stay forever.
All the Egyptian people.
We love Mubarak.
Words gave way to violence as clashes broke out across the square, with demonstrators facing off against Mubarak supporters and the police. While the battles raged around them, the military stood by, refusing to take sides. And while the soldiers watched, 400 people died.
I've seen several casualties on Friday the 28th, and that probably what made me decide that no, we will go on every day, Saturday, Sunday, and I closed my clinic and I informed as many patients as I could that we will not be back until something definite takes place.
The moment for me was on the 2nd of February, when I saw the men on horseback storm into the crowd, use their whips to terrorize the protesters. And I thought, a regime that does this to its own people, I cannot be part of their propaganda machine, the mouthpiece for a regime that massacres its own people. And that was the moment I decided I wouldn't be able to go back into that building again. I took out my cell phone and I wrote a message to my boss. Forgive me, I'm not coming back. I'm with the people, not the regime. And that was it.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM, and you were listening to excerpts from a documentary about the Arab Awakening, The End of a Dictator. That's the title of this documentary. Very fascinating. Has some segments in Arabic, but I'm sure it's pretty easy to understand that young people are expressing their joy at the simple fact that they can go to the streets and demonstrate against a dictator. Today is January 25th, and it's, I think, the 8th anniversary of the beginning of the end of the Mubarak presidency, but not necessarily the Mubarak regime. Ahmed, you were there when Mubarak stepped down. People were very hopeful that things are going to change. However, things are different now. Do you want to talk about that?
Things indeed are different from those days. Those days were full of hope. Sure, there was some uncertainty, but the opportunity to change things and to bring people together in the square there, in Tahrir Square, there are diverse people. There are religious, there are non-religious. There were different, you know, it represented Egypt, but most of it was young. Most of it were these young activists who led the way. Others followed later, and they provided that inspiration. And for different people, it was, you know, different things triggered them wanting to get in, whether it's the casualties they saw on the 28th or the 28th of January, or it was what was referred to in his documentary as the Battle of the Camels. This was one of the days, I think February 2nd, when the regime had hired these camel riders that normally work out, near the pyramids to give rides to tourists. They hired them to come in on horseback and on camels and attack the front lines of the sit-in. My brother was actually in that in Tahrir Square at the time, and he was there from the beginning. My brother Amir, and I guess for me that's what inspired me to head to Egypt, because I could tell that people were sacrificing so much to be there, and I wanted to be part of it. Since eventually all of this, their steadfastness, led to the Mubarak stepping down on February 12th because the state could no longer contain the mass protests. And when he stepped down, it was announced by the military. And the military, in a way, pulled a fast one on the people. They tried to divert attention. They claimed to be one with the people, responding to their demands. And that's why they, in a way, forced Mubarak to step down. And it became basically that the military was in charge until they have elections. And that's, you know, when things started getting interesting. The people that were in the square were once united. It now, looking back, the military itself started breaking up those groups. And then emerged different groups. There was a group called the Falul, the leftovers of the Mubarak regime. Yes, many of them are the powerful deep state folks that ran the ministry. Most of them, again, were military. He was a military guy, and ever since the Egyptian revolution in the 50s, every president had been somebody from the military. And the military, you know, for the most part, ran things in Egypt. It was like a state within a state. And it wasn't until they had the first free elections ever held. And after the runoffs, it basically became between a person named Mohamed Morsi and a person named Shafiq. And Shafiq, interestingly enough, was the last prime minister under Mubarak. Mm-hmm. He was a person that Mubarak, when he was trying to replace the government, because oftentimes these presidents, these dictators, will try to blame it on the prime minister and the cabinet. So they'll basically fire the entire cabinet and bring in new people and say, well, look, we're making changes. So the last person that Mubarak placed, in fact, he was the prime minister that was there when Mubarak stepped down. His name was Mohamed Shafiq. And at the end of the, you know, free elections, there were two candidates. One was Mohamed Shafiq, which was the last prime minister under Mubarak, and Mohamed Morsi, who was affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood and a civilian and had nothing to do with the previous regime. So those are the choices that the people had, because the military tried to, using their weight, push things towards Shafiq, and at the end, that's what they ended up with. So of course, the people chose Mohamed Morsi, not by a landslide, but basically it was polarized. So half the people with Mohamed Morsi,
so you
or
think,
you know, 52%, and the others were Shafiq.
So you think, Ahmed, if there was XYZ running also besides Mohamed Shafiq and Mohamed Morsi, you think people would have elected a third person, not necessarily linked to any organization or group? This could have happened.
Well, they did have that chance in the primary, I guess. I mean, the problem is the revolutionary forces or the groups that were united in the square, when it came time for the election, they were so divided by that point. There were different camps or different parties, and they were no longer working together.
I see.
Mohamed Shafiq should never been number two had they not had so many other candidates. So basically, you know, there was like four or five other candidates other than Mohamed Morsi, like Abu al-Futuh and a couple of others that were not necessarily Hamdin Sabahi, El-Baradi, that were not affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, but they all ran against each other. So they split the vote.
Yeah.
And then that enabled Shafiq to come in number two. So had some of those people had the foresight to back down, then you would have had a situation where number one and number two were revolutionary people that were with the revolution. But because the Falun, I guess the leftovers of the Mubarak regime and the military and the police, they all gathered all of their votes behind Mohamed Shafiq, where the people that supported the revolution split their votes five ways. So it made Mohamed Shafiq, the person who was under Mubarak, come in second place. So they had a runoff and it was between them. And once Mohamed, and this is basically, in hindsight, this is exactly what the military wanted. If Mohamed, their plan B, if Mohamed Shafiq did not win, they would set up Morsi for failure. They will continue to have chaos in the streets. And that's what happened ever since the 28th of January, when it became very apparent that the police had to step back and the military is taking over. The police, what they did, they withdrew from society. They released prisoners, these criminals from the jails. They wanted chaos to exist all over Egypt so people are afraid for their lives. So they regret that they ever rose up. So you had lawlessness. People were getting robbed left and right. The police would not respond. In fact, the police just stayed home. They stayed home. Even when Mohamed Morsi won, the police forces stayed home. So you had no rule of law. They did not return back to their jobs until Mohamed Morsi was overthrown about a year after his election. He was overthrown by the military in a military coup. And at that point, when Sisi came back to power through the military directly, then the police returned to their bases and started, you know, implementing security, and people felt, well, okay, well, we're at least safe now. So there was a whole what is now called the counter-revolution. These counter-revolutionary forces, they wanted to make sure the revolution that the people rose up for is defeated. And they went after a group to eliminate any opposition. And now you have some 100,000 people in jail in Egypt, political prisoners, not just the Muslim Brotherhood, but secularists, leftists, everybody that opposes the current leader in Egypt is in jail with no opportunity. And once they came to power, the military back in power, they banned protests. There's no if you protest today in Egypt, you will be sent to jail for 5 years. So they, even though they used, this uprising on June 30th to overthrow Morsi, they now, protests are not allowed in Egypt. So, and from as far as we can tell, things now in Egypt is worse than they've ever been. So even under, it's worse than Mubarak. It's worse than any other time in Egyptian history as far as the crackdown and the oppression that's happening there now.
Okay, Ahmed, I think we have a few other stories and segments that we can talk about. How about I play this song that I started the show with? It's long. It's called Long Live Egypt, Tahya Masr. It's about it became known as the Egypt Revolution song. And when we come back, I think we're going to be talking about something that just happened here in our state. This is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM. Listen to this music called Long Live Egypt.
مش عايزينك مش عايزينك يسقط يسقط حسني مبارك
حسني مبارك هو السيد وسام هو اللي لازم يمشي
مش هنستسلم ونرجع تاني تحيا مصر ولا نتنازل عن شيء تحيا مصر مش عايزين غير حقنا الإنساني تحيا مصر عدالة اجتماعية وعين تحيا مصر مش هنسكت تاني ولا هنداري اللي في بالنا كفاية ظلم وفقر وكفاية بامل مصر شبابها رجالة تحيا مصر وشعبها كله أبطال تحيا مصر مش هننسى دم شهدانا تحيا مصر جابلنا عزتنا من نظام تحيا لا عذاب ولا استبداد وفساد لا في مصر ولا في غيرها تحيا تونس وفلسطين والوحدة العربية مشوار بدأوا أجدادنا بكرامة هنبني حياتنا علشان دي مصر بلدنا وهنبنيها لأولادنا مشوار بدأوا أجدادنا بكرامة هنبني حياتنا علشان دي مصر بلدنا وهنبنيها لأولادنا تحيا مصر وتحيا الحرية ثورة حتى النص
Welcome back to True Talk on WMNF 88.5 with Ahmed and Samar. That was a song about the Egyptian revolution as we recognize and remember the January 25th revolution in Egypt. And Samar and I were talking about that experience and my participation in that. Hopefully things change for the better there. Now we want to shift to what's happening in Florida, in South Florida specifically. And before I bring on my next guest, I want to bring you up to speed on the story about a Hallandale, Florida commissioner who earlier or last week had posted on Facebook a very hateful comment saying that she signed a petition and said, proudly sign, and wrote, quote, a Hamas-loving anti-Semite has no place in government. She's a danger and would not put it past her to become a martyr and blow up Capitol Hill. She, meaning her name is Annabelle Lima Taub. She is a Hallandale commissioner, city of Hallandale in South Florida. And said she's a proud Jewish person and accusing Rashida Tlaib, one of the first Muslims in Congress who's from Michigan, accusing her that she wouldn't put it past her that she would become a martyr and blow up Capitol Hill. She doesn't know Rashida, but just because she's Palestinian or because she's Muslim, she was making that assumption. There was an uproar, an outrage, and it led to a commission meeting in the city of Hallandale Beach this last Wednesday, and the Miami Herald said Hallandale Beach voted Wednesday night to condemn one of its city commissioners members over remarks she made on social media that put down the first Palestinian American woman elected to the U.S. Congress. In a 3-2 vote, meaning two people sided with the commissioner, in a 3-2 vote, the commission officially condemned the comments of Commissioner Annabel Lima Taub, who said in a Facebook post that Representative Rashida Tlaib, a Democrat from Detroit, might become a martyr and blow up Capitol Hill. Tlaib is one of the first Muslim women in Congress. And Lima Taub, this is after the fact now, a week later, she remained unapologetic for the viral Facebook post stating Tlaib's support for boycotting Israel equates her with terrorist organizations like Hamas and Hezbollah. One of the people that spoke at that county commission hearing this last Wednesday is Rasha Mubarak. She's an Orlando-based activist, a Palestinian, and the president of Young Democrats of Orange County. Welcome to the program, Rasha.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. You went to the hearing, even though, you know, you're in Orlando, you went there. What moved you so much to go to this hearing? What about her comments that caused you to go there and speak out against it?
Not only are her comments jarring and divisive, but they are violent. They are inflicting violence on Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, but also the community in Hollandale, the state of Florida, and across the country. It activates this kind of hate that I saw firsthand in Hollandale when I went out there. And it puts not just the Muslim community, Palestinian community, not just the vulnerable community in danger, but I think it creates mayhem, and it's also unproductive in Hollandale. It's unproductive in Florida politics, and that's not what we need right now because we are living in dark times.
When you say that it's violent words. I mean, words themselves are not violent. You mean it's inciting violence?
Absolutely. Her words are violent in the sense that it can create violence. It gives bigotry and hate, and those that already look at Muslims and Palestinians and vulnerable communities in a light, it gives them a green light to continue to inflict violence and continue to be discriminatory and racist towards these communities.
Actually,
Ahmed, I saw some of the images.
Sorry, Ahmed, didn't mean to interrupt, but welcome to the show, Rasha. Actually, one of the letters that surprised me was from the ADL, which is the Anti-Defamation League. Are you aware that they actually sent Commissioner Annabel a letter expressing their dismay at her bigotry? Actually, they describe it as bigotry and hate speech. Are you familiar with this letter?
Yes, I'm also familiar that Senator Marco Rubio also denounced her. And when I spoke at the commissioner hearing, I told her that this is the people from the party, your party, don't even want to align with you, commissioner, that this is, you're dipping into the pool of white supremacy at this point.
Actually, let me just read excerpts, Ahmed, from this ADL letter. It says, in sharing your support for a petition aimed at removing Representative Tlaib from office, you stated a Hamas-loving and blah, 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 blah. Public officials should be able to vigorously defend and oppose policy positions without resorting to bigotry and the vilification of an entire group. Sharing and disseminating negative stereotypes like this, implying that all Muslims are or have the potential to be terrorists, is deeply offensive and has no place in our society. I mean, for her to move the ADL to write such a letter, I think it shows to what level what she said is unacceptable. My question, Rasha, is she still in office?
Yes, she's absolutely still in office. So many advocacy groups are calling on her resignation, and I'm the president of Young Democrats of Orange County, but I went on behalf of the Florida Young Dems, which is a statewide organization, and people are not only concerned, but when you allow and enable a person to continue their office and continue to be in that position and not try to unseat them, that's also, I think, something that we should all find alarming. So there's several petitions, there's several organizations and institutions that are calling on her resignation and that are going to continue to push for her resignation. And she's even announced that she felt empowered by her followers to possibly run for Congress in 2020. So it was just, it's not only is she not backing down and not only is she doubling down, but she, it sounds and it looks and appears to be from her words that she shared that night that she's even more emboldened. And I think that's what I find terrifying. And I think that it comes several days after so many of us shared Dr. Martin Luther King quotes or honored him in service. And the reality is our communities across the state of Florida need to speak out. And that's how we truly, pass on his message and honor his legacy, is by standing up to this kind of hatred. It's, you know, what may seem to be unpopular in a time for standing up for Palestinians and Muslims. And I think that people have to remember that during the civil rights era, it was the same exact sentiment. So we're hoping that Floridians and people across the country continue to speak out.
Before we actually play your comments from that you made at the county commission meeting, I was surprised by some of the images that I saw there, that there were possibly dozens, or if not maybe hundreds, of supporters of this commissioner who made this very hateful remark while she's being condemned by people within the Republican Party. There were dozens of activists that were there waving Israeli flags and heckling the Muslims that were there and the Arabs that were there, like yourself. I heard there were some, you know, very racist comments that were being spewed at Muslims and Arabs as they were attempting to hold a press conference. Things, like calling the Prophet Muhammad all types of names. Did you hear those comments yourself?
I didn't hear those comments. I before our community arrived, I was alone at one point because we had a specific time for our community to come out, and they had shown up from the early hours of the day, apparently. So I was called an animal by a group of men that, and they're calling Palestinians men animals. So and they're talking about how the men treat women, and how just, it was just very derogatory. And honestly,
were these people waving Israeli flags as they were doing this?
Oh yes, and they put even like their Make America Great hat in my face and their Israeli flags in my face, and were mocking my.
So these are people who are so they're waving Israeli flags and wearing MAGA hats in support of Donald Trump, and they're out there. The Miami Herald article said that they flooded the county commission room in support of the commissioner in question, and she had a lot of support. In fact, she went as far as saying, tonight may very well be my last night alive. She said this during the county commission meeting. How is this possible when most of the people there were supporting her, and it was the Arabs and Muslims like yourself that were made to feel unsafe? Were you shocked by those comments that she's made, that she thinks this that night might be her last night alive?
I wasn't so much shocked. I understand that she probably received death threats from individuals on social media. And I even told her, I said, you're looking at someone who has also received death threats because of people that you have aligned yourself with in this room. Laura Loomer, who has published false information about me and others, I go, we've received death threats because of people you've aligned with and because of how you continue to speak as a public official.
Ahmed,
I sympathize with her on the death threat, but I also told her that her behavior can be a contributing factor to others like myself.
Let me play this segment.
Sure.
Rasha, just a second. Trying to reach it.
Don't start me yet. speak up just a little bit.
Don't start me yet, please. Okay. Give me a second.
Your name and your city.
Yeah, that's when you're going to start me?
Yes.
All right, let me breathe for a second. I want to make sure I get all of this out, you know, in 3 minutes. So.
Country fast enough. And in the 1940s, the world decided to execute about 30 million people. 6 million of them were Jews. Half the population of the Jewish population of the world. Now we have a congresswoman who uses the platform of the foremost democratic body in the world. We champion ourselves as the leaders of the world. And she wants to destroy Israel. Israel has no place to exist. Well, I just checked Google. There are 8.8 million Jews in Israel today. Again, half the population of the world. Are you guys going to put your signature on paper?
Thank you.
Susan, rescind that.
Thank you.
Susan Lewis? Please state your name and the city you reside for the record.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm down, my darlings. Susan Lewis, Hallandale Beach. For 46 years. I know you're all tired. For almost 47 years.
I'm still ahead of you.
Tired of hearing that. Okay, I'm saddened. I know I've stood here before and told you how proud or how disappointed I am, but I'm really, 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 really.
Okay, Rasha, can you tell us, maybe I didn't put the right segment, so can you tell us how did the, like any Muslims speak at that hearing?
Yeah, so there was a few of us that spoke, and I think, I want to say I was the first one from our communities to speak, and when I got up there, you know, I was already recognized from people who knew who I was, so the heckling had to be done, and when I started to speak because of the severe disruption from the opposition, they had to go into a recess. And Commissioner Lima Staub tried to calm them down, and then there was arguments between the mayor and another commissioner of can go into a recess. So it,
it was, I mean, I watched some of it and it was chaotic.
Let me see if I got the right segment. Just a second.
For dialogue. I believe that when things happen, even the worst things happen, we can make good come out of it. But you chose to double down on bigotry and hate. You attacked Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib solely because of how she chooses to worship, solely because she comes from a Palestinian background.
Stop it. Stop it, please. Stop it.
I'm calling a recess if this commission chambers cannot control themselves, with all due respect.
So obviously they couldn't control themselves, Russia, and give you a chance to speak.
Right. So we went into recess.
I feel like part of this, as soon as she said the word Palestine.
Yeah, it's like, how could this word be mentioned?
It just erupted. Like, how can these people don't even recognize that Palestine or Palestinians is something that it ever existed. They want to erase it from the history. It's like the worst of the worst of the anti-Muslim, anti-Arab hysteria. It just all came together in that commission hearing.
Right.
And Russia was there. How did it feel?
It was intense. And, you know, people like yourself, Ahmed, and some of the, you've seen hands-on in the state of Florida being in the face of hate like that. I think it was a little intense just because it didn't seem like there was orderly in the commission and the leadership. So I was kind of wondering, like, you know, if something were to go down, how would one feel protected? But I did feel compelled to continue to speak. I said I want my entire 3 minutes back. I want to have an entire 3 minutes, you know, reset when I speak. And when I sat down with allies from Jew defenders and Jewish organizations, and they made sure to block people because people were still having their phones and getting in my face and asking me questions. And so the law enforcement had me sit in a corner so that I'm away from all of them. But the allies stood with me. So it was intense. You don't feel safe just because of the environment.
We do have to continue to speak out, and I'm grateful for our allies that continue to do that with us, the Jewish organizations. And
I want to thank you, Rasha Mubarak, for being on True Talk. We're nearing the end of the show. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in and those who are watching live on Twitter, and reminding our listeners that they can go to www.wmnf.org, click on the tip jar, and please give True Talk as much money as you can. And thank you for your support, and thank you for keeping WMNF on the air. This is True Talk on WMNF, and NPR News is next.